Okay, thanks everyone for joining us today. We're joined in person by David Goldblatt, the author of the book, The Ball is Round. We're covering the second half of the book. The first half is available on the website, our discussion from the first half. And I'll turn it over to Peter Ludgy to introduce our guest.
I'm not sure why we're taking such a formal route. Alex, but it's fine. I've had the pleasure of introducing David several times over the past couple of days. We're working him hard here in East Lansing.
Getting our money's worth.
He gave a public talk on his new project yesterday, and at noon today he gave a wonderful seminar. It was really a nice dialogue with our graduate students over the radio documentaries that he produced for the series The Power and the Passion in particular. And so today it's a great pleasure to welcome our friend David here in person. He's, the author of the acclaimed The Ball is Round, A Global History of Soccer, for all anti-clerical agnostics and atheists around the world. We can refer to it comfortably as the Bible of football studies without offending anybody. And he's also a columnist, a book reviewer, and he is an academic as well. He's taught for many years at the University of Bristol in the Department of Sociology and also at the Open University. And he's currently in a very fine gig as a visiting professor at Pitzer College in California, just outside the LA. And he's an award-winning reporter for the BBC World Service and BBC Radio 4, covering topics such as the economics of baseball in the Dominican Republic, the politics of football in Israel, football and social development in the slums of Nairobi, globalization of cricket, and Senegalese wrestling. So it's great to have David join us in person and for the second time here at the forum. Thanks very much.
It's a pleasure. Pleasure to be here.
So we usually start by asking the author for anecdotes about the writing of the book. We've already covered the first half of the book with David. I was wondering if you could maybe just riff on a little bit about the stewing period that you've talked about, especially for the second half of the book. Over drinks last night, you told us about some of your Latin American research trips, but as we can see, the second half of the book gets almost even more broad with the spread of football. So any stories or processes of inspiration that happened in telling the second half of the book that differed from the first half?
I can't quite remember what I said last time, but
you can say it all again.
I think the first thing to say is that I wrote it. I didn't write it in order. I wrote it. You know, I wrote the African bits, then I wrote the Latin American bits, then I, you know, went back and wrote, you know, like the Asian bit, and finished up writing most of the European stuff at the end because I thought that I was most familiar with that, and as time got shorter and shorter, which it inevitably does, that would be a sort of sensible place to be finishing on. So that was that was my first sort of take on handling the enormity, I suppose, of the writing task. I mean, what I was saying to the graduates earlier, and I don't know, you know, everybody writes differently, but I learned doing The Ball is Round that I need a run at things, and that I can't. You can't do it just in a half hour snatched here or a day snatched here and a day snatched there. It's like a kind of great juggernaut, and you do need time to get going. And it was much better when I had, you know, a week or two to devote to something all in one block. I think the main thing, the other thing I learned is about waiting, a certain amount of waiting. That, you know, I'm sure everybody listening in, you know, has spent a lot of time in front of their computer or around, you know, the house finding other things to do other than start writing. I certainly suffer from that. And partly that would make me frustrated and slightly sort of guilty. But I realized over time that a certain amount of that is actually an essential bit of the process. And it's not to be feared that there is, that the brain, when you're in the right mood, as one, you know, when you finally got to the computer, you're in the mood for really thinking about it, but there needs to be a lot of thinking. And the broader and wider you go and the less reliant you are on a very clearly defined, pre-established narrative, when you're trying to carve up something both engaging and abstract and, you know, of scholarly sort of weight, actually you just need to do a lot of processing and thinking and going back and forth. And I write stuff in my head, and I sometimes virtually sort of speak it out, or kind of imagining that I'm in a lecture situation. And I would do a lot of that, and then I would finally sit down, and I found then I would be writing at speed, you know. So instead of turning out, I don't know, 500 words in a day, I get to the point where I could write 3,000 words in a day, you know, and you do that for a week and bang, you've got a big long chapter. But I had to have the 3 days of kind of musing, I think, to do that. And I think I also learned, you know, I think we all know this from our writing, you need tactics and strategies to keep yourself engaged and to remind yourself that the rest of the world actually doesn't really know very much about it at all, and what has become slightly mundane to you might actually be really engaging to others. And I mixed up, I learned to sort of mix up my research time, you know, I did some reading, then I did some YouTube, then I had some, you know, video to watch, then I'd go back to my notes, and I would kind of consciously structure a day or two around that kind of program to keep me excited and to keep me interested. Because I think, you know, if you're not interested, Lord heaven above, how anybody else is going to be interested. So I think that's a really, and I think it's underestimated in particularly in academic life. You've got to kind of be loving it at some sort of mad level. You've got to be loving it, and you've got to find ways and feel okay about that, you know. So that, I learned a lot of process stuff that would be my main. I mean, there's all sorts of tiny stuff, but like in the round, that's, and when it's good, you know, I kind of, that's part of the, it's sort of strange legacy is having done that, and how amazing it is to be able to write at that sort of level of flow. You know, it's like you always want to be recapturing it, so it sort of sets a sort of really insanely high standard, and I have to kind of not beat myself up about that as well.
I mean the book that you're writing now, I mean, like, in a couple sentences, can you tell us about it, and is that happening?
Currently provisionally titled Football at Twilight : Britain's Endgame, and it's the mini version of The Ball is Round. I promise, mini, like 250 pages tops, and it's Britain 1989 to the present, the cultural politics of football. It's going to be less narrative-driven than The Ball is Round. It's going to be probably much more popular cultural in its focus, and probably slightly more polemical. You know, it's kind of, we're writing, it's weird to be writing the history of one's own time, so I kind of am treating it less as a kind of formal historical exercise and more as a slightly sort of polemical and cultural intervention. And starting it was absolutely bloody agonizing. It was really, really, really hard. I actually really did sit in front of a blank computer screen for 2 days, which I'm sure you've all done it, and it's hell. And I beat myself up like mad about that. And what got me out of the rut was to go, you should really watch some more stuff on YouTube. And I decided to watch a lot of stuff about England fans abroad, traveling England fans, because actually when I wrote The Ball is Round, much less stuff up on YouTube of that kind of amateur video. Mm-hmm. And I tracked down amateur video of, you know, the fights, the squabbles, as well as the singing of England away from as early as 1992 all the way through to the present. And at the end of that, I was suddenly like, oh, man, this is so interesting. I can't believe what I didn't know. I didn't think about that. And then I sort of started writing. Mm-hmm. And I'm picking up pace. The first 1,000 words were like in blood, right. But you know, the last sort of like 3,000 or 4,000 have been, oh, okay, you're not as bad as I thought. Okay, I think we're getting there. So, you know, hopefully by chapter 6 we'll be an express train.
Well, we usually start off in our online realm with questions first. I have an order in front of me. Why don't we start with David Kilpatrick?
Unmuting myself there. Well, first of all, I just want to say, you know, I wasn't part of the first session, but The Ball is Round has had such a profound impact on me. I just want to follow up in terms of that, in a post-theistic sense, this is a sacred book to me, and I want to thank you for that, even though you're a Tottenham fan. there's a lot I could ask about, so I'll try to narrow it down. First of all, in terms of The economic crisis, I'm really taken with what you say about linking up the society of the spectacle with what Berlusconi accomplished at Milan. And I'm also interested in kind of what seems almost like a liminal phase that you describe, that you sketch out in terms of the old firm. I'm, you know, the crisis going on at Rangers right now, I think, is a really interesting case of overspending and what can happen to clubs when they're not responsible and they're not really necessarily being used by a politician for their own personal aims. So I guess, if anything, I'd be curious to hear what a contemporary follow-up would be to your historical perspective, rather in the moment, in those passages in the second half of the book. And the second point on that would be just in terms of what you're saying with football at twilight, the idea of critical historiography or you know, more polemic, I think you used the phrase cultural intervention. I wonder how you negotiate that from one project to the other, and what makes you feel like taking a more polemic dive with this next book.
David, well, just thank you so much for your very kind words. I mean, it really is, you know, I know truly felt, and it's like, wow, how amazing. You know, most writers go all their lives waiting for someone to say stuff like that. So that is really, you know, profoundly and gratefully received. And thank you very much. In terms of polemic and cultural intervention, when I wrote Ball Is Round, I felt, as I still do, you know, I'm a football outsider. I'm not part of, I don't run with the press pack. Man, I don't even have a press pass. And the only time I ever get into anything for free is like via the BBC, you know, journalism that I do. And I didn't feel ready. And I suppose I didn't feel quite so passionate as I do now about the political dimension of football. I felt like part of the argument of the Ball Is Round for both myself as well as the wider public was to say, you know, this thing is political with a small p. And not only that, but, you know, there are choices to be made about what kind of politics you want to have. You can't get it out. The debate really should be is about what kind of politics. And I think, you know, because in particularly in England, and I say England rather than Britain, the mainstream media and absolutely the mainstream professional football culture is so dead set against that notion. I felt like I've got to establish my credentials first, you know, because who am I to speak on this topic? And though, you know, I mean, looking back on the Ball Is Round, really the only bit where I really let properly loose is on FIFA. And I felt confident. I thought, no, I've got your number. You people are, you know, and everything that I wrote and all the stuff that I didn't put in because we were worried about the lawyers, I should have put every last bloody word in on them. So I think having written The Ball Is Round and been able then to sort of go away from it and just simmer on kind of, you know, what I've personally learned about it, I now feel ready to return to the fray. Like, you know, I've got a position and I've got some credentials, and it's like, it's okay for me, for myself anyway, to be much more polemical about it. And I, in terms of an intervention, I sort of think, you know, again, having established a sort of minor little sort of role in that world, again, I have the possibility of making a political intervention in a way that, as a kind of very unknown, you know, 10 years ago, that I couldn't have done. So it's about sort of, you know, personal and intellectual confidence, really, I think. And I think it's also when one comes closer to home, you know, the Ball Is Round, it was a great privilege and a great, great intellectual experience to be able to write about the whole world, and a dream come true, actually, in many ways. And I've sort of slightly got that one out of my system. And I've been wanting, you know, your eyes turn to your own patch. And I felt like I hadn't even begun to do justice to particularly contemporary British and by which I mean English, Scottish, Welsh and Northern Irish football. So that's part of it, I think, for me. I think also the end of New Labour and the jolting reality of being returned to the Conservatives in government has made me, that gives the whole thing much more of a political edge for me. I slightly feel like I sleptwalked through New Labour and I'm feeling intellectually and politically guilty about that. And that's part of the motivation, I think, for coming back in this way to the topic. And then in terms of the things you were saying about Rangers and Milan, I mean, Rangers is, Rangers, you know, I mean, partly it's the kind of, you know, the foolishness of all modern and contemporary football, where the, you know, the pressure to overspend and the kind of insane dynamics of competition without any kind of safety net or controls like you have in American sport makes this, you know, so there's just one more of these. In that sense, Rangers is no different. On the other hand, I think what's special about the Rangers case and is peculiar to the Scottish situation is that, you know, this is a team whose self-image and level of support, you know, makes it rightly think in some ways that, you know, we should be competing in the elite of Europe. We should have a kind of, you know, a sort of standing and aspiration that, you know, Tottenham or, you know, Marseille, you know, why should we be thought of any different from Marseille who are in the quarterfinals of the Champions League? And the problem with it as an economic strategy is that, you know, they've exhausted all the possibilities of screwing more money out of the Scottish, tiny Scottish football economy. And this goes for Celtic too. I mean, you know, the two of them are as bad as each other. And they can't, and I don't think they ever will, as far as I can see, get themselves into English football. And I think post-devolution, it's just sort of inconceivable that that's going to happen. And so much rides on being able to get regular European success as a way of kind of making the book. It's a really huge gamble. The only way, apart from all the dodgy tax accounting, that you can kind of survive on Rangers' strategy is to kind of consistently get huge European income. And it hasn't worked. They've not been good enough. You know, it was a bad gamble. And I think that's a problem. You know, a lot of peripheral, smaller, you know, football economies in Europe facing the same kinds of dilemma. I mean, I can't believe that nobody in Portugal has or is about to go bust. I just can't believe that, you know, given the state of the wider political economy of Portugal and what we know to be the unorthodox financing methods of the leading Portuguese clubs, I sort of think, how can they not be in the same sort of situation? So I'm sort of wondering whether there might be a bit more, actually, of that to come. It won't just be Rangers. There'll be more of this in the next couple of years. I mean, you know, what price the books of Olympiacos? I wonder what they really look like.
Right.
And then on Milan and Berlusconi, I mean, you know, you just, like, he's such a loathsome man, but you've so got to take your hat off to him. That's how I sort of feel. You know, respect is due to the devil. And he is, and he's, I can't begin to express how much I don't like him, and consequently Milan. But he really put the package together. And if he hadn't got diverted into politics to protect his, you know, his legal status, I mean, I think Milan would have been actually much, much more dominant. And I think, you know, they've sort of slightly paid a price for his inattention, in effect, because I think more than, you know, he's a class impresario, and he get under the skin of the Italian football fan, just knew how to do it. And he understands the sort of showmanship side of football and would have put out sides that, you know, get the punters in. So that's my thought. I mean, I think it's all over for him, really. I don't think even he can come back. Peter's, yeah, rightly. I know, until the stake is through the heart, we can't relax. I understand that. But I think it's probably over. So, yeah, that's my thoughts on that.
Great.
Thanks. Could I just have a quick follow-up on
sure.
that? You talked about the not having the press credentials, and as an academic who writes on soccer here in New York, I can relate to that in many different ways, and also my frustration. I know Jonathan Wilson, you know, with the Blizzard, has tried to rectify this in his own way. But if you could just talk, this, the state of soccer writing and the lack of a real critical edge, and some of the reasons behind that, maybe the freedom that someone like yourself has to really engage the sport in a more critical manner.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are virtues of being absolutely on the outside. And yes, you're right, you know, the Blizzard is all to be applauded. And I'm going to be writing something actually for it later this year on why Bristol has such crap football teams, which is an essay I've been wanting to write for a long time. The lack of critical edge, you know, it's... Oh, man, I don't, you know, I mean, I can't quite get it. I mean, you know, I have a lot of contact with these folks in some ways, you know, particularly with Five Live, Radio Five Live, which is, you know, as fantastically mainstream as you can possibly get. And I'll tell you what I think part of the problem is that, and this is what I experience in the UK media anyway, is that the football people want to keep it old school, particularly the commissioning editors who really have all power and are fantastically conservative folk, even though, you know, like the guy in charge of BBC Sports got a first in history from Oxford. It's like he just like threw that out when he walked through the door of BBC Sport, from what I can make out. So it's really hard to get in there. And then on the other side, you know, particularly, I mean, television, let's not even go there because, you know, the agenda is so nightmarishly bad. But in the context of radio and the sort of serious newspapers, there's a real problem where, you know, you're pitching stuff or you're arguing stuff and these people are going, shouldn't this be on sports pages? And you go, yeah, but your sports page people never do it like this. This is not their shtick. And then they go, oh, you know, but the people who are like listening to my program, they're all coming here to escape from the football, you know. And it's really, Radio 4 is the classic example of that because... and we're a bit stuck. There's a generational thing because, you know, Radio 4, for those of you who don't know, is the kind of NPR, the premier talk radio station in the UK. It's what the elite listens to, but it has a kind of big audience beyond that, a fantastically good reputation. And, you know, I'm forever pitching stuff, and I'm fine with what I'm getting back is, this is great, but, you know, our audience doesn't do football. And I go, yeah, 30 years ago, I'm your audience. You know, I can tell you 100 people who are your audience, you know, and they haven't caught up with that sort of shift in the amongst the punters. And I hope, you know, I'm holding out hope in the next 10 years that we get a bit of that.
Alon.
Hi, good day to everyone. David, I already praised your book enough times to yourself to, but as I was looking over it the last few days, I really enjoyed again just, you know, combining Herman Hesse's The Glass Bead Game and Ecological Disaster and all that other good stuff. So a question about the Middle East, since I'm immersed to in finishing the co-editing of a book on the Middle East. And actually, I might have to leave a little early because the deadline is looming. But... I was very happy to see that in the book you talked about the development of the game in Algeria, Morocco, Egypt, Turkey. Where do you see it going now? I mean, beyond the immediate, you know, things that get into the press, riots and the ultras, have you been thinking more about the development of the game over there?
Most definitely. I mean, and, you know, with hindsight, I think I'd have... definitely wanted to write more about Asia in general and about the Middle East and West Asia in particular. And, you know, certainly in Iran and Iraq, there is a kind of, I realize there's a gigantic, great body of work to be done. And, of course, Qatar and 2022 would be an important part of that story. And I think I would want to spend... and I continue to want to spend more time kind of understanding why, for those Gulf elites, football has proved such a sort of phenomenal form of soft power, and why they have invested, you know, so much money in it. I mean, you know, because by the time this is before Manchester City have bought up, before the other investments have been made at PSG, and I can't remember the Spanish club that's been
Malaga.
Built up, Malaga. So on the one hand, there's that kind of whole external story of buying influence and soft power in the world. I've also now been to the Gulf, which I hadn't done before. And I think, you know, until one sort of actually gets there and is completely blasted away by what's an extraordinary environment to be playing football in, that it is, that kind of really captivates me. And, you know, it's... And to understand why your average kind of citizen in the Gulf is so captivated by football. And that's a very difficult... I was in Dubai for sort of 5 days, you know, doing other stuff and kind of itching to sort of get out and meet the locals. And that's a really hard thing, I think, for, you know, the one-off visitor to the Gulf to do. But that really, really intrigues me. And I don't have an answer. I don't have an answer to the question, but I know that I would go... I would want to do more. I also think the other thing that I would do, and I think I underestimated at the time, is the kind of actually extraordinary ethnic and religious complexities of publics in the Gulf and in the Middle East. And, you know, we know Lebanon is a mosaic, and I knew from Berbers in Algeria, but the Arab Spring and the kind of degree of what I'm sort of learning from that is making me rethink. Making me want to revisit, because I think, you know, like a lot of ignorant outsiders, you know, it's like Gulf Arabs, you know, I couldn't go, and then suddenly I'm going, oh, the Shia, there's this, there's that, there's, and that's been a huge, great learning curve for me. So I definitely want to be doing more for that. I mean, I'd say on the question of kind of riots and ultras, while clearly, you know, there's a bigger story. What has gone on in Egypt is truly exceptional. I think that it really does repay much, you know, there's more to come here. To have ultras so systematically involved in, you know, the cultural politics and indeed the real politics of football, this I don't think there's anything to compare what's happened in Egypt. This is way beyond the kind of, you know, basically slightly playground far-right, nasty racist political interventions that you get amongst some ultra groups in various parts of the world. This is a level of self-organization and intervention and kind of collective social political learning going on that is, like, quite special. So I would, I would want to do that. I would really, really want to come back to do more of that. And, of course, the other thing is the whole question of social media, which... Amazingly, the ball is round is really dated. Bloody hell, it's 6 years. And I, you know, there's no mention of Twitter. How extraordinary.
Thank goodness.
Well, yes, you know, from one sort of like personal life, but I mean, in terms of the football world, you know, Wayne Rooney's got 2.5 million people on his Twitter feed. He may not, and he actually writes some of that. And while we, you know, that's really bloody interesting, you know, as a kind of distant historian and intellectual, you know, I mean, you know, or, you know, these guys are tweeting during the kind of London riots and they're being listened to. I mean, in the sense that a lot of people are checking out what they've got to say. So, and of course, you know, in a much more kind of radical and interesting way, the role of social media in the Arab Spring amongst football supporters seems to be a really kind of important thing. So, we're all... my conclusion is the Arab Spring... made me reassess a lot of stuff and made me think a lot of stuff, and I would want to go back to all of that.
If I may add something, some of the issues. Can you hear me? Or
No problem.
There's a book that just came out that I think it would be worth our time also to include the author, Mahfoud Amara, who's from Algeria and teaches at Lancaster or someplace like that. Sport, Politics, and Society in the Arab World. And he doesn't focus only about football, but he does address football in Algeria, stories like during the War for Independence, the team that was formed out of Algerian players playing with the resistance and so forth. And he addresses a lot of these issues of development, media, elites, and so forth, Islam. I think with the Middle East, two other important issues that are reflected also in the I'm co-editing an issue for Soccer and Society and also a book for Routledge about the Middle East. One is Islam, of course, the role of Islam. Some Israeli scholar actually recently wrote, there's a lot of interesting stuff, but somebody wrote analyzing the different kind of fatwas against soccer or in support of soccer. I mean, apparently even with religious fundamentalist Islamist, there's even among them there's disagreement. But so I think there's interesting work to be done there and is being done. Another thing that's also exciting is the story of women and soccer. Two of the contributions we got are studies and interviews. One is by a professor from Northwestern University who teaches now in Qatar, and he did a study with a local woman student who's an athlete, and they interviewed a lot of women soccer players in Kurdistan. And then we also have, hopefully the person will submit it in time, but her dissertation is about Palestinian women soccer players in the Galilee. So I think, that is another area that maybe in the next edition, I mean, when I look at your book and I look at previous general histories, I'm amazed at the fact that you did address all these other, countries which sometimes are called fringe countries, but also women. But I think there's probably more over there to be developed.
Yeah, no, unquestionably, and I'm looking forward to those books, Alan.
Okay, thank you.
When are they coming out?
What?
When are they coming out?
Inshallah, pretty soon. You know how it is with editors and with submissions where people promise and never. So I've been praying on Friday, on Saturday, on Sunday, on Monday, so hopefully soon. Let's put it in the book. You end by saying there are 6 billion of us. I hope it will be out before there are 8 billion of us.
Corey, I saw you dropped out and we skipped over your chance to ask a question. Do you have one?
No, not right now. Thanks, though.
Okay. How about Brenda?
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm really interested in, and thank you, David, for coming again, and I'm sorry I missed the last session, but I was really interested in the shift that you're talking about between politics with a little p and a big P, and it sounds like you're going rogue with this new project. I'm really excited about it. So I wanted to ask you, you spoke about the pervasiveness of the assumption that politics is apolitical and how sort of wedded this has been. And I wondered who you thought or what types of ideologies this was serving. I mean, who benefits today from the continued weddedness to the idea that football should be, is, has been an apolitical practice?
I mean, I'm speaking very specifically about England here.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the notion that football and politics, both with a small p and a big p, are linked has been, pretty obvious to everybody in continental Europe and most of Latin America, for the last 100 years. I think it's, the very peculiar ideological formation of English sport at the moment of its formation and codification in the 19th century. It's at the aristocratic presence, the large, and the sort of ideology of amateurism that kind of shaped that distinctive way of thinking about it. I think it's also very characteristic of both of different elements of English civil society over the last 100 years, in the sense that, elites have looked down in many ways. The literary and political elites have looked down on sport in general and football in particular. I mean, we can, on both left and right. So you've got sort of Orwell arguing in the 40s, rather disparagingly, football is just, he says it's war minus the shooting, but not in a kind of interesting or effective or progressive. It's just, it's sort of slightly dismissed. And then, you've got the
you know, your senior civil service, your leading politicians, many of whom kind of overlap with the senior administration of the Football Association, who have that peculiar, I mean, and again, you know, it's sort of, this is ideology at work, because of course the use of sport by these social classes, particularly in the empire, as an instrument of, you know, control, acculturation, etc., is super and deeply political, but, you know, has been wrapped up in a whole load of other stuff about the white man's burden and about, you know, the bringing of civilization. And that's all kind of, they want that depoliticized. And I think those ideologies, there's also a kind of deeply, deeply anti-intellectual strain, both in aristocratic and elite cultures in Britain, and most definitely in working class cultures in Britain, particularly the kind of artisanal, upper working class aristocracy, trade union movement, all basically, you know, which is, to me, is closely linked to the leading cadre of football players and managers, who are exactly that kind of aspirant, artisan working class. And indeed, you know, this continues to this day. If you look at the kind of class makeup of England sides, or of managers, or of, in fact, most English players in the professional game, I mean, it is just gigantically and overwhelmingly working class in a way that you really, I don't think you see almost anywhere else. And that is a very, very anti-intellectual culture. You know, it's all about, it's English empiricism, it's learning on the job, it's a distaste for continental flummery and theory. And, you know, you'd find exactly the same if you walked into kind of Anglo-Saxon philosophy departments and their attitudes to the continent. So I think it's not just one group, it's a whole range of different social groups and social classes, both those inside sport and those outside sport. I think it's about some quite deep historical ideologies that took, you know, took a big chunk in the culture in the late 19th and early 20th century and have not really been re-examined since. So that's, I don't know if that's quite covers it, but that's my sort of take on, that's how I would pitch it.
Yeah, thank you. That's really interesting. Thank you very much.
No problem.
Ben Healy?
Sure. Just a couple quick questions. I remember in the foreword when you talked about how after finishing the book you did sort of a football detox and turned to NBA, NHL, NFL for the next year. I'm curious, sort of once you reintegrated back into football, what you noticed upon your return, if there were things that you know, that you were sort of struck anew by coming back into it. And also, I was just it was interesting how you mentioned repeatedly that just before the 50s, it's very difficult for us to see how the game was actually played, lacking continuous video footage and that sort of thing. You know, now with everything that's on YouTube, it's so much more pervasive even than when you were writing the book. That's a tremendous opportunity for scholars. I'm wondering how you think the expansion of the archive in that way, what implications that has for collective memory of the game, if that affects the way things work on a broader social level, or if, you know, live sporting events remain, you know, every bit as evanescent, even though they're captured everywhere on video. So just curious about those two.
Good question. So first, yes, my detox. What did I think when I came back? Well, I learned a lot about America. So that was the first, I basically knew a lot more American history at the end of that process. And that was obviously underplayed in the Baldish Round and kind of deliberately and rightly so. But it was really great to kind of engage with American history in a more profound way. And it was sort of my route into it, because, you know, it's quite hard at the beginning when you're checking a kind of country's history. And there's so many books on American history. I really, really didn't know where to begin. So it was quite nice to have a way in that worked for me. I came out of it, you know, with renewed and deepened respect for aspects of American sporting culture. And this is generally, I should say, my experience of living in America, is all the things that are great are even greater and more brilliant to actually be here. And then all the things that are a complete nightmare are even more nightmarish when you close up. So, you know, my love-hate relationship is getting yet more intense. I think I learned that American sports sort of, you know, the relationship between American sports culture and American writers and American intellectuals is a lot more fruitful and interesting, broadly speaking, than it has been certainly in England and most parts of the world. And I think the quality of, you know, both the best of American sports history, and I'm thinking of Jules, and I can never pronounce his surname, Jules Teagle, just I thought that was a masterclass to read his work on baseball and American history. And, you know, but also to read kind of George Will and a whole load of other dudes who you wouldn't normally, like George Will is really not on my radar normally, but it was great to read him on baseball. So that was, and it kind of gave me renewed confidence and courage to sort of go out into the public realm and try and write in that way about sport, because I thought, well, if it can be done here, you know, then one should keep at it. This is good stuff. I also learned particularly the whole sort of baseball moneyball side of things. That just brought a whole new way of thinking about sport. American sports, you know, obsession with, you know, metrics and mathematics and statistics, which is partly to do with the culture, partly to do with the nature of the games, that. And, you know, that's coming into football now. You know, Prozone is changing that. But that was really, really interesting to think about, and it's made me kind of want to look at football in a different kind of way. I think learning a lot more about America's, you know, very socialist, basically, systems of revenue redistribution and the draft and so on. That was, I came back to, you know, with sort of like a bit more kind of equipment for thinking about the kind of political economy, disastrous political economy often of football in many places. So those were all, I also just came back really liking baseball and really liking basketball. I find hockey, I mean, if I lived in a very cold place in Canada, I'd get into hockey, but I think certainly hockey in LA is just simply too absurd for words. And American football, you know, respect is due, it's important to understand, but it's definitely not my cup of tea. So I learned, but I really, really got into baseball and basketball. So that's, yeah, lots of things came from the engagement with America. And also just American writers often very good just talking about ethnicity and race. I mean, sometimes disastrously coded as well, but I thought the best of it was very upfront. And I kind of like that about it. And I think people have, that gave me more confidence to write on that, those kinds of topics. So that's my first thought. Sorry, remind me of your second question, Ben.
Just sort of now that a video record of the past of the game is so ever-present.
YouTube question. Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, again, yeah, like I said, you know, we're already out of date. No mention of Twitter. And YouTube, you know, wasn't bad in 2005, but compared to what it is now, you know, it's absolutely unbelievable. And I mean, I was speaking actually with Alex and Catherine earlier today about the whole problem of archiving this for future historians, because stuff comes and goes on YouTube as it comes and goes on websites and blogs and so on. And there's an absolutely unbelievable set of resources out there. I mean, I was saying, I think, I don't know whether we were saying, I don't want to repeat myself. I was talking about looking at the YouTube England stuff. I mean, this is, you know, amazing to be able to kind of find amateur video footage of, you know, England fans in public spaces in Japan in the 2002 World Cup. Just extraordinary to be, you know. I mean, I was interested in that regard. I was interested which are the songs that have been released as the official World Cup songs that actually have some bite and fans continue to sing. And the only way to really find that out is to look at them in the fan parks. And, you know, I found them singing Vindaloo in the fan park in Japan. And that's like a really amazing little piece of information to come across. So I think there's a huge, great archiving sort of task to be done. And someone ought to do it. I mean, in terms of old football, which gives us more of a feel of the game, I haven't been looking, to tell you the truth. But I'm, you know, open question here, what's out there, guys? But I'm still, you know, I was looking the other day for some old World Cup stuff, and it's pretty thin on the ground. And I just think the old school you know, before it's television, when it's film and it's just one or even two cameras, and they don't quite know what they're doing, I'm not sure we're going to get much better. But, I mean, I'd be really, really pleased to be proved wrong on that.
How about Ben Detmer?
Hey, can you hear me?
Yep.
Hey, good. First of all, David, I apologize for leaving early yesterday. We had an intramural soccer game that I had to go to, but Alex and Peter are also on the team, but I'm in goal, so I couldn't really stay and listen to the end of the talk. I apologize.
Did you win?
We tied 3-all, Peter.
Okay, we'll take the point.
We could have used a striker. We could have used you up there, but anyway. As a quick aside, from your earlier answer, I used to work for the BBC when I was doing my master's degree in Glasgow, and we used to get a lot of I worked in the complaints department. I would answer, you know, when somebody was angry about somebody swearing on the TV, I would write a letter to them and try and placate them.
Uh-huh.
And we got a lot of complaints about our sports reporting coverage being biased. And I would write a lot of these letters, and particularly when it was journalists or academics saying something on there, we would get a lot of letters about things. We found that ex-players could say anything they wanted, but as soon as a journalist came on and said something, they were immediately biased. And producers and editors of shows just didn't want to touch these people. So maybe that's something, you know, going back to what you were saying earlier on, about not being able to get on the BBC very much. But living in Glasgow, I'm interested in the part of your book where you talk about the Tartan Army and Scotland fans. And this kind of accepted history we have of them as being the best fans in the world, almost. And I wonder why that is, and I wonder why we don't question that so much. I mean, if you go to Glasgow on an Old Firm day and see those Glasgow Rangers and Glasgow Celtic fans, it's very, very different from being the best fans in the world. And even the Scotland fans themselves are known for being kind of xenophobic a little bit. They've been accused of that by Neymar recently when Brazil played them. And there's a famous footage of Scotland fans swinging on the bar at Wembley, for example. But kind of the wider implication of that is, you're probably quite familiar with the history of Scottish football, but when you went into these places where you're not quite so familiar with, how did you kind of wrestle with that? Just accepting the accepted history that people told you or that you saw, and then what actually got into the book, and kind of using Glasgow and Scotland fans as the base for answering that, maybe?
I think the Scotland Tartan Army question is a great one, and one that I am currently thinking a lot about, actually. And the key fact there is that, as we know, Scottish civil society has managed to have huge levels of collective amnesia about the depth, scale and form of sectarianism in Scottish civil society for the last 90 years. You know, so before we even engage with the Tartan Army and the best fans in the world, it's like, that's the dirty secret, as you know, of Scottish football and of, you know, the Scottish nation. And what the Tartan Army, you know, very sensibly did, both by inclination and organisation, is to say you can't bring club colours and you don't talk about your religious affiliation in the context of Tartan Army action, because the moment we do that, the lovely unified bacchanalian, you know, gruff but gracious Tartan Army will reveal that other side of Scottish society and Scottish football. So that's, I think, how the Tartan Army have pulled it off, was, you know, as with all reinventions of national identity and public performances, it's a selective one. And, you know, because it makes me laugh in some ways, you know, that the Tartan Army is the kind of emblematic of Scotland. And you think about actually like mainstream Scottish elites and, you know, the Kirk, the university and the law. And it's so sort of Protestant and straight-laced and patrician and avuncular at best. And, you know, the Tartan Army is just actually one part of the jigsaw of the meaning of contemporary Scottish national identity. And, you know, what it seems to me made it such a great success is that sort of raucous working class central belt element, which has been bound actually to labour unionism in unionism in the political rather than the industrial sense, you know, for the previous 30 or 40 years, comes on board with the kind of Scottish nationalist project at that moment, but of course leaves out the sectarian dimension. So I think that's how the Tartan Army managed to sort of pull that trick off. And, you know, they also played very right. They played a really strong card. It's like, we're not English. and the English were doing absolutely their best, you know, to be as unpleasant and you know, hopeless as possible, which obviously made the task easier. I mean, I think the really the other thing with the Tartan Army that's really interesting is, you know, 98 in a way sort of feels almost like their peak at France, you know, in France, while the English are fighting Tunisians and the riot police in Marseille. The Scots are kind of, you know, helping old ladies with poodles through the kilted masses you know, wearing kind of, you know, Brazilian shirts to the Brazil match. And, you know, devolution has just happened. And it's almost like football and politics at the level of the nation has actually been slightly depoliticized, and it's less seen sort of less important, because now Scotland is for real. You know, Scotland's got a real parliament. Maybe it'll be independent. And the kind of existence and survival of the Scottish nation as a cultural thing is like, if it was ever in doubt, it sure as hell isn't now. And it's, you know, you're even getting voices which are sort of wondering that whether kind of stereotyping and buffoonery, which are not my words, but the words of Stuart Cosgrove, is really what one should be doing as a kind of mature, aspirant, independent nation in the 21st century. I mean, that's a debate for the Scots to have, not for me. I merely note that that is the debate going, that's the debate going on. So I think that's how the Scots, yeah, that's sort of my Tartan Army answer. In terms of the places that I didn't know anything about, what was my strategy? How did I do it? I mean, what I would often do in a place is sort of, you know, I would read the conventional histories first and foremost. You know, I became a very, very good skim reader, and I became a very good kind of organizer, and I was slightly sort of model undergraduate, you know, kind of doing my kind of paper, my sort of, you know, right, Uruguayan history, term paper, let's do it. So there was a certain amount of that. There was a certain amount of, you know, after a bit, I got a feel for it. You know, you would sort of read the history of a country and learn something about its ethnic makeup, its urban structure and all of that. And you'd be thinking, I bet I know where there's a football angle along here, or there's going to be a connection. And sometimes one would be right, but one's hunches were generally sort of quite good, I think. In terms of believing the histories of what I heard, I never believed anything. I mean, I was a complete skeptic with all people telling football histories, but not a skeptic in the sense that I was dismissive, because I think one of the really interesting things in football history is the myths that, you know, the historical myths that football cultures tell themselves about themselves. And, you know, that often is even more interesting than actually sort of what happened. It's like, well, why does this myth work? Why does this story have traction, you know? Or why was it such a good story that the press and the football culture chose to elaborate on it and shape it in a particular way? And so I was never worried that I was being spun, you know, hoary old myths or, you know, old, frankly, sometimes old wives' tales. It was like, no problem. What's interesting is why this stuff matters to you guys. So, yeah, I have my skeptics hat on at all times, but I was always pleased to hear that stuff rather than thinking, oh, no, this is no good. Somehow I've got to get to the real story that, you know, is beyond that. Because actually that stuff often is the real story.
Great. Thank you. Thank you.
We can shift over here to our in-person presence here. Why don't we just, yeah, as we maybe ask our questions, we can just say our name briefly. And
I'm Andrew Guest, and I'm here on sabbatical enjoying David's visit. And I guess the question that's bouncing around is probably related to some of what you've been talking about here and some of what's in the book. But yesterday you said one of your underlying theses is this idea that football doesn't just reflect history, but it actually drives it in a lot of cases.
I don't know if I said a lot, so that would be my caveat on that.
Okay.
Sorry, is that the question?
No, no, no. I'm putting together a question. I mean, what started bouncing around in my head is that I suspect you wouldn't have a lot in common with the way you think about things with Sepp Blatter, but that he would probably make a similar argument that that sort of, you know, putting the World Cup in South Africa, putting the World Cup in Qatar, like that was his effort to kind of use football to drive history. And another thing that strikes me in all this stuff is, I think for somebody who takes a sociological lens to a lot of things, you strike me as surprisingly optimistic about the potential of football. And so I guess my question is a very macro level question, which is, what's the trajectory that you see, particularly looking, because when I look at the big picture of global football and the World Cup in Brazil and the World Cup in Russia and the World Cup in Qatar and all these things, and what happened in South Africa, I'm fairly pessimistic. I think South Africa organized a magnificent World Cup, but FIFA left with all the money. I mean, the development goals were completely subverted. And so, you know, just the way this in the sort of the arc of history, and with having gone through a massive arc of history, how do you see the trajectory at this point?
I'm a Gramscian, you know, pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will. I mean, you can't, you know, if you're basically on the left and you study the history of football and you're not an optimist, you know, it's going to be a really depressing ride. So, and I'm also generally, my disposition in life, I'm quite kind of, the glass is half full, not glass half empty. So that, I mean, that's generally how I am, I think. So I bring that, you know, and I sort of wear my heart on my sleeve generally, and I bring that to my writing, and I think that's important. It's not for all books and all writing, but sometimes it's important. So partly that's what makes me an optimist. The second thing that makes me an optimist is that I think we are, you know, looking back over the history of football, you think, man, people really didn't get, you know, that people have so actually underestimated the potential of it. And actually, for most of the history of football, most of the people who follow it, you know, it's quite an unreflective culture. You know, people are loving it, enjoying it, and playing it, and rightly so, because unless there's that, there's nothing. Right, but then the kind of meta level of where you're slightly standing back from it and going, hold on, this has real social implications. This is actually something, you know, we don't merely play or follow, but we can, you know, take control of or use or have a part of in a sort of conscious, organized fashion. I mean, that is the world, you know, I'm sort of reaching for the word postmodern, but really I think the work of Ulrich Beck, which says, what makes changes modernity is when modernity gets reflexive about itself. And now we have a football culture all over the world, from, you know, Sepp Blatter, you know, to fans on the ground defending La Favela against, you know, takeovers by the World Cup committee, who are being reflexive about the use of football, you know. And now that we've got kind of social media and a kind of emerging intellectual historical discourse, which provides a degree of legitimation and historical argument to support that, I sort of think, well, this is new territory. I mean, the idea that there could be, you know, some sort of global conversation, organization, and challenge to FIFA from the grassroots of football and football fans, you know, for all the limits of what happened during Blatter's re-election, inverted commas, the fact that there was anything, it seems to me, is this is a remarkable development to get there. This is really, really special. Or, you know, you look at the anti-racism campaigns in European football. I mean, that football could function in an organized fashion as a way of actually challenging, you know, racist policy and practice, not merely in football, but in the wider society. You know, 30 years ago, it is inconceivable that something like that could happen. And for all the limitations, and, you know, we can criticize and find limitations, still kingdom come. But there's been real change. And I think there's more on the way. And I think, you know, again, 20 years ago, we sort of knew that football was really popular in Africa, and, you know, that there's obviously football and development's got a connection. This is a global social movement now. You know, and, you know, will it be controlled from above? You know, will it deliver on its promises? I mean, these are other and more open questions. But the very fact that we can even begin to pose these kinds of questions and investigate these phenomena, that's enough for me. I feel like we've crossed the historic divide there. And the possibility of taking all, you know, the full, you know, finally, the possibility of taking the dark lords on is available to us. And I don't think that was even there 50 or 60 years ago. So I have a, you know, so that, I think that's what makes me optimistic, is that at least there's some territory now to fight on. Before, we were going, where's the territory? And I think, so that's, you know, and then we have a choice. You know, then we're back in the realm of politics. You know, we can play the politics badly, the bad guys can win, but at least, like, we're in the ring. So I think that's, you know, that's what makes me optimistic. Okay, now for the pessimism and the arc. I mean, you know, one of the things, again, even there, though, you know, you know, let's go for the positives. I mean, you know, the gender transformation that is, you know, we are only at the bottom of the mountain of, and is beginning. That's, you know, this is major. I mean, this has been an overwhelmingly masculine and highly sexist culture for 150 years, right? There's no point beating about the bush. That's how it's been. And indeed, you know, in terms of football shaping the world rather than merely reflecting it, football's actually, you know, contributed and reinforced all sorts of stereotypes of masculinity, both in the stands and on the pitch. On the other hand, you know, you think, you know, it's like, how are we ever going to deal with that? Well, you know, the young women of the world are dealing with that and are getting out there and playing football and beginning to make their mark. And the numbers are impressive. You know, and again, it's no problem. I'm sure we can come up with an absolutely gigantic list of why it's not going to work and what the problems are and the limits. And, but I kind of think, you know, looking macro, this is a really huge change. And that's been one of the great things about being in the US, is to sort of see that in the flesh. I mean, last night at seeing Peter's Seven Aside, it was preceded by, you know, kind of 45 high school young women, you know, doing a kind of major workout, and it was like, whoa. And, like, you know, not playing city buggers, it was like, well, I'm quite pleased I'm not doing this session, because I think I'd look a bit of an arse if I did. And so, you know, that's like, to really see that, you know, knowing that there's a lot more of that and there's more to come, because I think once the cat's out the bag, it ain't going back in. So that's exciting. And that seems to me a really kind of major transformation. I think the more, the less optimistic one, the trajectory at the moment, clearly the kind of balance in an institutional level, and it will eventually be financial, I suspect, from Europe and Latin America to, you know, the new powers of the global south, both in the Middle East, you know, the new kind of situation in Russia, China, you know, these people are going to be very powerful. And clearly, you know, Qatar and Russia's, you know, acquisition of the 2018 and 2022 World Cup, you know, sign of the times. And that's worrying, because these are places with really, really despicable domestic politics who bring that to the table. I mean, you know, it's worse. I mean, I said this in The Ball Is Round, you know, I'm almost nostalgic for the era of Havelange and his kind of dismissive, arrogant patrician. But, you know, at least the man had some charisma and some chutzpah. And it was like, actually, you know, it's not at the level of an entire nation state bribing its way to the World Cup, which is frankly what we've had. I mean, never mind the bloody FAs. This is at the highest level of government and elite politics going on. So I sort of am slightly, I almost wish the sort of personalised feudal politics of Havelange was back. So I think that's worrying. And I think, again, it's a mixed bag, you know, with the experience of the ISL relevant revelations and the bribing for the World Cup and the Sunday Times, is that on the one hand, it's like, how come you guys still all there? Jack Warner's gone, you know, but, like, I want more heads on more stakes, really. My bloodlust is not satisfied by this. And it's like, how did you get away with it, you know? On the other hand, I look at it and go, wow, you know, senior politicians, parliaments, judiciaries, maybe even police forces, you know, in powerful nation states suddenly going, hold on, how did these guys arrogate this level of power, status and authority to themselves? How come there's no checks and balances? This is not on. The battle's still to be fought, but the fact that we're actually having that conversation, I mean, I think it's, you know, well, it's great that England didn't get the World Cup. I'm so pleased, in the sense that, you know, now you've got, you know, English politicians suddenly looking at FIFA and like, this is a problem. So I think that's just the optimist in me. You know, so that's kind of that arc is interesting. I'm kind of interested to see what happens as Europe gets older. I mean, you know, no disrespect to us all, but, you know, football is a young man and woman's game, really. I mean, you can play it, but it ain't like golf, you know, which you can, and particularly at a kind of professional level, you know, you need a pool of young people. And Europe is getting really old. I really feel that in America. It's like I come from an old place full of old people that's getting older. And I wonder how, you know, and you can see that, I mean, the economics of that in the Premiership, where crowds are getting, you know, the age is creeping up and up and up of the season ticket holder. And I sort of wonder what that will do to the game. I slightly sort of worry about that. And I'm not sure football's been very good at dealing with, you know, it's begun to deal with age and, you know, with gender, and it's dealing with issues of ethnicity around edges, but that's a huge, in Europe, different here, but in Europe that's such a big, going to be such a big issue, is intergenerational stuff, and I slightly wonder whether football will deal with that very well. I mean, just in the sense that there will be less players, less quality, it'll be a less interesting game at a professional level to watch, you know, but we'll see. We'll see how that turns out. That's my, we could go on, but I think I'll shut up at that point.
Thanks.
Alejandro.
Well, I'm Alejandro, and thank you for, again, for the book. I mean, this is great to see a book of this kind. And I guess I have two questions. One, I mean, as I'm starting to study soccer, and I mean, I'm starting to get into this field. And by looking at what you did with the case of Latin America in this case, I was wondering, I mean, what is your vision, I mean, after revising all these documents and books that relating the case to Latin America, what are the gaps that you see that, I mean, need to be working in the case of Latin America? I mean, Alex, I mean, is working on that. I'm working in Mexico. So what are some, you know, hints, you know, to where to look at in this process that at least is starting?
Well, the first is Mexico. That is the biggest gap of all. And it's so good that, you know, you're doing your PhD on Mexican football. Thank you very much. I mean, certainly in English, I can, you know, because my Spanish is not good enough to kind of engage with. I can read Marca, but, you know, I can't really read the real stuff. No one's done Mexico. You know, Roger Magazine, I believe is his name. Slightly anthropological study for clubs. Good, and great. Thank you, lovely. But without much historical background, I was sort of reading this and going, yeah, but like, what happened for the previous 90 years? I really need to know. And it's very, very, very thin on the ground. I mean, I'm embarrassed to say, you know, Mexico is a kind of ghostly presence and only actually sort of really appears around, you know, the two World Cups that it's hosted and sort of in connection with, you know, the PRI and Club America. And, you know, that's just a great, big, huge gap at every single level that needs to be filled in. So that's the first stage. I think the second thing is this Latin America, it's part of sort of the region to an extent. It's the whole Caribbean element, you know, which Laurent Dubois has sort of, you know, helped us greatly in the French-speaking zones. The English-speaking zones have not been dealt with. Where is the stuff on Trinidad and Jamaica? I mean, I'm really interested to read that. In terms of, you know, South America as opposed to the kind of wider Latin America, where are the gaps? I mean, the gaps are all over. I mean, in the sense, you know, where's, you know, each of, you know, certainly Argentina and Brazil, you know, are worthy of a singular monograph on the history of Brazilian, the social and political history of Brazilian football. I mean, how has come no one's written it? I mean, I just sort of think that needs to be done. You know, that's, I mean, and then we can find loads and loads of gaps in the scholarship that would help make that. But, you know, no one's written the history of Argentinian football that I know. You know, I mean, there are some sort of quite journalistic attempts, I believe. And there's some sort of, you know, there's some stuff in Spanish from Argentina, often written by journalists. But, I mean, it just seems to me it's crying out to be written. So at that level, that sort of monograph synthesis, but with some original research to fill in the gaps, we definitely need that. I would like to see much, much more on, you know, the sort of popular culture. I mean, again, you know, we've got some great journalists who kind of scratch the surface for us. And so, you know, one learns about, you know, the relationship between African forms of Christianity in Brazil and Catholicism and football. Great. That's a great connection. Two nice anecdotes. You know, we'll have those. But then you're thinking, right, this is ripe for study. Or the relationship, you know, is it a myth, is it not? The relationship between body culture, dance, and football, right? We've all made that case. We all know the argument, you know, and we have some quotations here and there, the odd bit of work. But actually for someone to really, you know, and of the caliber of Eduardo Archetti's work on tango, and Brazil, Tango and Argentina. So, like, there's a book to be, well, A, there's a bigger book to be written about Argentina, about that, but the Brazilian version and, you know, beyond. I mean, I don't know anything about dance in Colombia or Chile, but it's, pretty good. It'd be better than it is in Europe, that's for sure. So that kind of, so that realm. I mean, you know, I'm waiting for somebody to write, you know, I would like to see, you know, the work and the contribution of, you know, people like Mario Filho, you know, properly translated into English. I mean, it strikes me, you know, or Nelson Rodriguez, I mean, you know, who writes all this amazing stuff back in the 50s and 60s. And I, you know, I'm not going to learn Portuguese. I can't, too old. And, you know, I should, I know, I should be a linguist in every field. But so there's an area, all of that stuff. For the non-Portuguese reading speaking scholar, it's like just totally off limits, you know. And the whole kind of oral culture and the radio, I mean, and television, I mean, I'm waiting a really, and this is particularly in the case of Mexico, we know the relationship between Televisa, the PRI, Club America, right? There's the triangle of power, football, television, and politics. And that, you know, we can make that claim for Globo at certain periods. So I want to know more about the television. I want to, how was it presented? You know, how was, you know, I want a cultural reading of all of those elements of the culture would be, you know, would be fantastic to see. I mean, I could go on and on and on. Fan cultures of, you know, I mean, barely been, you know, barely, again, the Barra Bravas, we've got a little bit on those, you know, but given what those guys have been up to over the last sort of 20, 30 years, I mean, man, there's a whole load of stuff that needs to be done there, so I really like to see that. You know, and the Andean nations, again, what I'm generally finding is there's like one scholar who's kind of got on the case in that region and started the ball rolling, which, of course, you know, is great and we're all thankful for, and it opens all lots of, like, you know, that's all really interesting. So they're sort of setting the field, but it's like, actually, when you start pulling the bibliography together that's available anyway to me in English, it's very, very thin. So those, yeah, that's a pretty big shopping list.
It's a good one. It's a good shopping list. Giovanni?
Yes, actually my question is similar to Alejandro's. Alejandro, yeah. I really love the book, and looking at the parts on Africa, firstly, I was just wondering, I really enjoyed the football and the belly and how the politicians used football there, or how football worked out in politics. But then one thing that I was wondering around that was the link between how young the states were themselves, given that, you know, the geographical boundaries were just drawn after 1885, and from 1974 to 1990, some of the countries that we are looking at were hardly 10 years old, and others, for example, like Namibia and Zimbabwe, that's when they were getting their independence. So I was wondering on the raw how that actually how that background played in football, and given that around the same time as you indicated, for example, when you were talking about Kaunda's efforts in fighting colonialism and apartheid, and the politics around that in connection with the colonial powers that were strongly linked to some of these countries that were still being colonized, in terms of weakening the economies of the country, which consequently affected football. And so I was wondering around that link. And then the last one as well is your views on, you indicated about the politics, the Francophone and Anglophone politics, continental politics, and how that linking them up, and your views now after South Africa's host of the World Cup. And lastly, exactly the question Alejandro asked concerning the work that you did on football in Africa, the serious gaps that you identified and the challenges that you experienced, as you indicated to me earlier.
Great. The first, in relation to, you know, the legacy of colonialism, I mean, this is a, you know, I'm just a little kind of pinprick in a gigantic debate about how you write the post-colonial history of Africa and who you're going to, you know, it's the blame game. It's like crap elites, crap colonialists. Who are we going to, how are we going to weigh, I mean, in a very crude sense, you know, and I've had, you know, kind of Mozambican, not Mozambican, you know, Angolan communists, you know, have a real go at me and sort of say, you know, the problem is not about the colonial elites and about the colonial legacy. It's about what African political elites did after. And actually, you're not giving them enough weight. You don't give them a tough enough time. And then other people, quite reasonably, coming from another part of the debate, are saying, you know, look at these states. They're 5 minutes old. They've been denuded, you know, of like all their kind of core staff and infrastructure, and given a shape and format that's a complete disaster by the colonial settlement. You know, the process of independence is managed disastrously, etc., etc. And I'm slightly, I mean, I kind of, you know, I'm like well in other people's territory here in terms of how that debate works out. So I try to be, I suppose, sort of even-handed. What I'm hearing, and tell me if I'm wrong, is that I've not given sufficient allowance for that. I thought of the disastrous quality of the colonial legacy. You know, so there, it's a kind of hard balance. So actually, I think it really, really varies between, you know, between countries as well. I mean, I think there are some places where, like, you always knew Congo, was it ever going to work? I mean, irrespective of, you know, the CIA involvement, you do sort of wonder whether whoever had been in charge, whether that one was ever going to work out. Whether there are other places where you think, well, this is less about a kind of colonial legacy and more about some really disastrous struggles with inside new elites. And so I think it's actually a bit of a case-by-case study, and one would have to be a really super-duper Africanist to be able to make the right call on all of those. And, you know, sometimes I think I got it right, sometimes I got it wrong. You know, I mean, I felt like with Nkrumah, my account of Ghana and Nkrumah, that was, you know, they had a real, it had a shot of being a really, it could have been a really successful post-colonial state, and it looked for a bit like actually it was on the right lines, and they made some good calls. And then, you know, in the early 1960s, you know, Nkrumah makes some really disastrous decisions and goes down some really bad paths. And I mean, that's, you know, but so that's the debate. So that would be my answer to your first question. Remind me the second question. The third question is about gaps. The second question was the question in the middle. I thought I heard three questions. Correct me if I'm wrong, everyone.
We can just go to that.
All right, we'll go. In terms of gaps, and how do I sort of put it all together? And oh, Francophone, Anglophone. Okay, I mean, what is it with the English speakers of the world? I mean, we're all slightly disastrous global networkers. It's like Britain in the kind of, you know, the European Union is hopeless at building alliances. You know, the United States is not always the most successful at building kind of global networks of alliance support and goodwill, as it might be. And, you know, you think the same about even South Africans who, my impression of the South Africans is that, you know, they have a certain kind of arrogance towards the rest of the continent, and that's, you know, black, white, coloured, Indian, all South Africans basically slightly look down their nose, and particularly at Francophone Africa in the rest of the continent. That's a sort of really hopeless piece of colonial baggage that every ethnicity in New South Africa seems to have inherited, and South Africa's diplomacy strikes me, and it's diplomacy, but its attitude to much of Africa is, like, obviously we're the boss. Obviously, why isn't everybody getting on board, you know? And they don't play that game very, very well. And I thought some of the kind of pan-African qualities of the World Cup were pretty clumsy, actually. Power to the opening and closing ceremonies, which I thought did do that. And, you know, African music, you've got the Algerian guy singing, and, you know, and it was good. It's like, at last, an opening ceremony with some good music. Thank the Lord. And it would have been nice to have done more than that. I thought it was incredibly disappointing on that they had the Black Eyed Peas as the headliners of the gig before the World Cup started. You know, I just thought that was a disastrous decision. In terms of gaps, the most important thing is people need to get out there and do the interviews, because everyone's going to die soon and there's not a lot of paperwork. That is the singularly most important thing that's got to happen. You know, all the paperwork, you know, like, where is the Nigerian FA's archives? You know, it's lost. It's lost for the most part. And there's some stuff still out there, and hopefully, you know, some Nigerian football officials stuck some stuff in the loft. And that, I think, is the singularly most important task for the African sort of football scholarly community, is to save, you know, get what we can before the people die, because, you know, the oral history record is only there in people's heads, and if we don't get it now, we're never going to get it. You know, we've got 10, 20 years before another generation, you know, that really in the pretty thinly documented era is gone. So that, there's that task. I suspect that the colonial archives have not been sufficiently mined as yet, you know, not the stuff that's in Africa, but the stuff that's in, you know, back in Kew Gardens in London, or, you know, whatever nasties are in the Belgian archives and the French archives. You know, I reckon there's a lot of stuff, you know, and of course, not that people haven't been to these archives to write African history, but they haven't always gone there looking for football. They've been, obviously had other, you know, there are other issues to be addressed, but I like to think there's still a great repository of stuff uncovered there. And I think that the same process, you know, needs to be done. You know, there's a lot of infrastructural work to be done in the sense of, you know, football association, what there is left in Africa, what is the state of everybody's archives, you know, and are you going to let us have them? And if you won't look after them, and I have to say football associations are the last people who should be allowed to look after their own archives. And that goes across, you know, that just ain't Africa, that's everywhere. It's, you know, let's get them into the libraries in whatever format. And all the negotiation that can be done there, I think, you know. So that's, there's that. And then we come to actually, you know, the topics themselves. Where do we start? There's so, you know, there's just so much, you know, to be done. We've only got fragments, haven't we, in so many areas, you know, like, just to take an example, you know, Tanzania. You know, we know that Nyerere spent time used football clubs as a cover for meetings, right? And that you've got a degree of nationalist support being orchestrated around those. Great, you know, that's two lines for me in my book, but somebody needs, you know, that kind of, you know, where we know that there really was a connection, but we've never, you know, who's been through Nyerere's personal papers, you know, who's been through the club's personal papers exist, do any of the other significant nationalists of the era, do you know what I mean? It's like, there are so many good stories. I mean, you know, the FLN now has, like, actually had some pretty serious treatment, and that's like, so let's go take a look at the places where we know there are the connections, but we've only just scratched the surface. Or in Nigeria, I mean, you know, what's the nationalist guy called who sells war bonds?
Zeke
clubs. You know, it's like, oh, please. That's a whole book, isn't it? The Zeke clubs, you know, Nigerian independence, you know, the tours during the war. You know, I mean, I think that era, given how, again, it's all about age. I think the efforts have got to be as old as possible while there's still a chance of getting, you know, getting the paperwork and getting the stories and saving. And, you know, what will happen to old, I mean, I worry for the archives of African newspapers, you know, that would have been published in the early 20th century, how long they're going to last, you know. So I think there's a load of work to be done, but the older, the better, the sooner, I would say.
Peter?
I'm glad that Chipande got Africa into the conversation. I'm not going to continue on that track because we're kind of starting to run into almost added time here. But I've been thinking a lot about football economics lately. Mm-hmm. I'm doing a seminar paper at the University of Michigan very soon about FIFAnomics and South African nationalism. And on page 685, you tap into what Szymanski and Cooper highlight in their book, Soccernomics, and that is that while soccer is big business, actually there's very little profit, if any, being made. Mm. And it's this very interesting paradox. And you say on page 685, as for the bottom line, football is better cast as a bottomless pit for absorbing foolhardy investments. I wonder if that's Abramovich, I'm not sure. It has proved almost impossible, by legal means, to make a football club profitable. And yet, it seems to me soccer has played an extraordinary role in pushing the ideology of neoliberalism globally, particularly starting in the 90s and intensifying in the first decade of the 21st century. So in your opinion, to what extent did it strengthen or even affect the broader attitudes that everything is up for sale, everything, even your emotions, your innermost humanity is for sale, and we talked about this in South Africa, right? The slogan of the World Cup, what was it? I shouldn't space on this. It should be rolling off my tongue, you know, in multiple languages.
Africa's humanity or something.
Can you spell it?
No. Africa's humanity.
There's a word.
Celebrate Africa's
humanity. Celebrate Africa's humanity was trademarked.
That's it.
It was a trademarked phrase.
Yeah.
Don't you dare celebrate Africa's humanity, you know, in your store or in your church, you know, without paying your dues to FIFA and Yellow Sea. So what's your take on that? Because the second half of your book, particularly the last third, is really wonderful how you bring the commerce in, heavy duty. Capital plays such a big role, whereas in the first half, it's much more international politics and sort of national politics. And here you really shift it to high gear into what I think is still just so important, you know, our transition to a market society, if you will.
Well, I think, you know, broadly, you know, historians and macro sociologists 100 years from now will look at this era as, you know, that there was a really significant shift between, you know, who's got the biggest clubs in the world. It's, you know, it used to be the state and now it's looking like the market and those who do best at it. And that's a macro shift across the world, across the individual countries, and of course in football as well. And I think I would say people do make a profit out of football, but it's not the football clubs. I mean, people, HOK or whatever they're called now, who build football stadiums, have been making a lot of money. People who make bucket seats, they're making good money. I have no doubt that Nike and Adidas and all of that crew are making money coming out of their ears. So what's kind of odd about football is that the central industry, right, is doing its brains, as we say in English, but the suppliers, and maybe this is how it works in the car industry, you know, GM is losing money hand over fist, but the people who make the battery, you know, and the light bulbs, they're doing great. And I think there's an aspect of that in football. And I think you can, of course, a few clubs do make profit, even legally, but if you measure it in terms of rates of return as a kind of sensible way of investing your capital, Warren Buffett is not investing in football. When he invests in football, then we'll know that, you know, the rate of return is actually worth it.
But John Henry and Thomas Di Benedetto are.
What, making money or investing?
Investing.
Well, I think they're going to find that they're going to get there. If they think they're going to make a rate of return better than they can make on the NASDAQ or whatever from Liverpool Football Club, I do think they're going to be shocked. I think they're going to be surprised in that regard. I think if they get Liverpool to consistently break even and have a moderate level of regular success, they'll be doing fantastically well. But in terms of, yeah, the justification of providing part of the sort of ideological backbone for the global, you know, neoliberal nightmare, I think it has done in part because, of course, the quality of the conversation that's going on in football culture, both within clubs but in the kind of wider world of, you know, chat rooms and phone-ins, the actual quality of the conversation going on about the economics is just primitive. You know, and that's partly because they never have people, you know, if that's Stefan Szymanski on occasionally on 606, the world would be a better place, you know, because what is, it's complete and utter, pardon my French, bollocks that is spoken most of the time. I mean, there is this kind of, you know, level of journalism, what I would consider list journalism in sporting press, which loves the rich lists, you know, they republish the information from the large consulting companies and accountants who, you know, do the rich lists to associate themselves with football. And they, okay, you know, but there's never, it's always treated like there's a football league. It's like, okay, this is economics, guys. You have to actually just analyze this as in an economic and political fashion, and you're not getting that. So what you're getting is glitz, glamour, dynamism, the super rich have arrived, football's better because now it is more marketized and there's more money in it, right? But the level of actual conversation is so pitiful, you know, that has been for most of, you know, the last, you know, 20, 30 years. So I think that's partly how they get away with it. And I think, yeah, it's... I mean, we'll see how the Premiership does. I mean, much of the argument, in a way, is sort of hinged on English football used to be, you know, disreputable and crap, right? And now it's the centre of the football world, question mark. And it's obviously the most, you know, the most marketised. But again, where is it marketised? Actually, where the marketisation comes in is the fact that clubs are up for sale. I mean, in terms of being a kind of, you know... a completely free market in other regards, it's not a free market. I mean, it's a kind of semi-closed system, and it's clearly not a free market in a conventional sense. I mean, the idea that football clubs, you know, are individual kind of economic agents competing with each other and trying to destroy the opposition to maximize their own profit, all of this goes out the window once you actually start engaging with what football really is and how the dynamics of it work. Actually, it provides loads of reasons that all of the classic rational actor neoliberal market models are just that. You know, they're a fantasy land that doesn't apply to the real world because, I mean, as we were saying, Arsenal and Tottenham, you know, in the world of economics, Tottenham wants to put Arsenal out of business. But in the world of football, it's the last thing we want. You know, because where's the pleasure? Where's the pleasure? Where's the meaning? Where's the fun? It's just like, it's a completely irrelevant calculus to it. And I think that's, you know, it's ended up, I think you're right, Peter, to say it has had that effect, but it's only had that effect because the quality of the conversation and the interpretation, which would not be the case if we were dealing with an industry that was analysed on the, you know, in the Financial Times and the Wall Street Journal at the level of kind of proper critical scrutiny, it would never last for 2 seconds. But and that's both the amazing thing about football and the deeply frustrating thing about football. Something I was going to say earlier is about the grey area. You know, football's often in a grey, it's in a grey area economically. Is it the market? Is it not the market? You know, is it working? Is it not working? And it's in a grey area legally. You know, what can be applied to this? It's in a grey, it's in international politics. It's a very grey area about sovereignty, authority, transparency and democracy. And it's like, this is great. It's the, it, you know, how did it, I kind of almost want, you know, if I went back to the borders round, I wonder whether that almost would have been one of my starting points. It's always in this bloody fuzzy grey area. How did it get there? And I think that's how it works out with the economics.
Aaron, do you have a...
Yeah, I do. It's going to feel very very lame following that. You talked a little bit about American sports culture and your own sort of detox. And I mentioned before that I'm a big fan of Major League Soccer, and I feel like there's always this sense of you know, when is when is soccer in America going to, you know, be legitimized? And I think that, or you know, stand on some level footing with football in the rest of the world. And certainly, there's a stigma that, you know, David Beckham or Thierry Henry or whoever, you know, Robbie Keane, whatever, can come to the United States and get a nice paycheck for a couple of years in the twilight of their career. And certainly that's true. But I guess I'm curious to get your take on this notion of the legitimacy of football in the United States, especially because, you know, Major League Soccer has made all sorts of attempts to tap into some of the European supporters culture, both in terms of the way supporters groups are structured and all of that, but also even things like the way they're building soccer-specific stadiums now. They look significantly more like stadia in the UK than they did when they started building soccer-specific stadia 18 years ago. So I'm just kind of curious about your overall response to, you know, legitimacy.
I think we're there. I think the battle's over. I mean, you know, your main problem is, you know, with Rush Limbaugh, as far as I can see. As far as I'm concerned, you know, for what it's worth, and I think, I'm not sure I speak for a wider, you know, I'm at the more cosmopolitan edge of European football culture, I would say. But I think we're here. This is a real football culture. Everyone should stop being so worried about it. You know, I mean, in terms of grassroots participation, you know, this place is like a billion miles ahead of most of the world, actually. You know, in terms of gender, in terms of numbers, in terms of engagement, you know. So I think you're there. I think in terms of the quality of MLS, you know, I mean, is it in the top five? Is it La Liga? Of course it's not, you know. But is it a very decent, serious professional league as good as the kind of, you know, smaller peripheral leagues of Europe? I mean, I would say it is. I can't see that much difference from what goes on in Scotland, you know, or Belgium, you know, from America. I can't see that there's actually there very much difference. I think that, you know, one of the great pleasures of the 2010 World Cup was seeing, the way American fans were operating, not just American games. They were everywhere, man, and they were often the noisiest. The Korean-Americans at the South Korea-Greece game, you know, were just fantastic and knowledgeable, engaged, you know, and overwhelming in their numbers. So I think I also look around the U.S. and, you know, you look at the numbers in Seattle and the kind of subcultures emerging or what's going on in, you know, around Chivas and Galaxy. And I just think, you're there, guys. You know, the main problem, it seems to be, you know, with, you know, the Fox, which is funny given that, you know, Fox TV, Fox Soccer, is a kind of key pillar of making soccer work in this country. And yet, you know, they're the people who are still punting that America is un-American. Football is, you know, soccer is un-American. Soccer is maybe not Republican. I think that's the problem. I mean, you know, and again, this is a very crude take, seeing Peter's team last night play. You know, here we are in East Lansing in Michigan. And this place used to be a baseball and softball practice area. And it's like, it's almost prehistoric, the baseball sign. You know, it's the gravestone, frankly, of baseballers' participatory sport. And the place is buzzing with soccer action. Starts off with all of these kind of the young women, right? Again, which is a whole phenomenon that America has that a lot of places don't. Then we've got the kind of middle-class university internationalist types, broadly speaking, and a few white-collar, blue-collar white dudes on the team. So that's another part of the football constituency. And then we've got the Latino crew, right, who are playing Peter's team. And there's the three kind of, you know, bits. And then, you know, so I'm loving it as a piece of Americana and just sort of anthropologically enjoying it. But you know what was the most telling thing, actually? Was the team that came in afterwards. You wouldn't remember, Peter, because you were a little cross and had other things in your mind at that point. But the next team that came in was a bunch of completely regular white American Midwestern dudes, right, who 20 years ago would definitely not have been playing soccer. Or at that age, you know, they're that second generation thing. They played soccer 20 years ago, and here they, you know, and it was quite, I thought, well, if this is a mainstream, I don't know what mainstream America is then, you know. So I think, you know, that's my answer. You're there, you know. I mean, yeah, there are kind of tossers all around the world who kind of want to make light of that. People are always looking for an excuse to have a go at America and, you know, all that nonsense. So don't worry about those guys. I mean, your own right-wing nutters, obviously, that's a whole other debate that America needs to have with itself. But even there, I sense that someone like, you know, 20 years ago, they were arguing this back in 94 at the World Cup, you know, and I actually think the voices are getting, not only are there less of them, but I think to more people in America, they sound more ridiculous, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's my, maybe I'm an optimist, you know, I'm an optimist.
Great. Well, thanks everyone for joining us today. Stay tuned on the website for an update, but what's most likely is that we'll turn to an edited volume, Soccer and Philosophy, in which David Kilpatrick has a contribution, and we'll try and get Ted in on that call as well. But thanks again, everyone, for making the time to chat with David. Thanks, David.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.